You are listening to Episode 1 of Quarter Share, a trader's tale from the golden age of the Solar Clipper. Written and read by Nathan Lowell. Chapter 1, Neris, 2351, August 13. Call me Ishmael. Yeah, I know, but in this case it's really my name. Ishmael Horatio Huang. My parents had an unfortunate sense of humor, but had they known what I'd wind up doing with my life, they might have picked a different name. Richard Henry Dana, perhaps. Why they picked Ishmael Horatio is a long and not terribly interesting story that begins with my mother was an ancient lit professor, and it ends with my being saddled with these non-sequitur monikers. That story was over 18 Stanyards before the two Neris Company security people showed up at my door with long faces and low voices. Perhaps it was their expression, and perhaps it was that they were looking for me and not Mom, but I knew it wasn't good. I was pretty sure they hadn't come to drag me away. I'd never been a troublemaker, not like some of the other kids in the university enclave. They had come for me, though, to tell me she was dead. It was a sort of an unreal kind of kick-in-the-gut feeling. I knew they were telling me the truth, but I couldn't quite grasp it. Flitter crash, the tall one said. It happens. Not a lot, but enough. You know it can happen, but it always happens to somebody else. It wasn't even her flitter, but Randy's, her boyfriend. He was dead, too, the short one said. They spoke to me gently, and their voices just washed past me. Nothing really seemed to stick. They finally left me alone. 18 Stanyards was old enough to live on your own on Neris. I wasn't taken to juvie hall or put into foster care or anything. That night I just kept walking from room to room. I woke up sprawled on the couch next morning, but I didn't even remember sitting down. As bad as that night had been, morning brought something worse. Lawyers. Pip said, "We carry stores for up to 120 days, but we're seldom underway for more than 60 at a stretch." When he told me that, I got a funny feeling. 60 days. That's 2 months. During the few days I'd been aboard, I'd been too busy learning my new job and finding my way around to think much about being cooped up inside the ship for weeks at a time. What would it be like when I was trapped in the ship for 2 months? Pip poked me. "Ish, Ish, it's okay." I took a deep breath. "Sorry, it just hit me what I was doing," and he nodded. "No worries, you'll be fine. Just keep working." I nodded dubiously. "I suppose, but the ship seems so small." He looked at me oddly then. "Small?" he croaked. "Yeah," I nodded. "Everything all packed together. The narrow passages. You know, small." He got a speculating look in his eye. "You've never seen the ship, have you?" "Of course I've seen the ship. I'm on the ship, aren't I?" He shook his head. "No, I mean seen the ship. The whole ship." He bipped Cookie on his tablet and asked, "Cookie, request permission to show Mr. Huang the way to the bridge?" Cookie's response came right back. "Don't get in the way up there," he said. "Granted, but return quickly. We need more coffee. The crew will be back aboard in 3 hours. We closed the freezer, and Pip led me up a couple of levels and down a passage. At the foot of a stairway, they call them ladders on the ship, he paused. "Don't touch. Just look. Pay attention to the bridge crew," he instructed softly. He climbed the ladder and said formally, "Request permission to enter the bridge?" "State your business," a rating at the top of the ladder responded just as formally. "Orientation for new crewmen," Pip replied. "Granted," she said. Pip stepped onto the bridge and I followed. The room was relatively large. 3 large chairs were bolted in key locations, and an array of smaller workstations were laid out around the room. A doorway, a real door, not a hatch, was open in the back of the room and revealed a small conference table. The lighting was subdued, dim even, with most of it coming from the glow of various panels and screens. I could see one screen that displayed what I took to be a Neris planetary schematic with the orbital base and planetary surface plotted on it. A larger scale display showed the host system with a blinking blue path curving across it. It took me a few moments to register that there were actually ports facing forward. The ship was nuzzled up against the outside of the orbital. I'd seen pictures of the station, of course, and watched it on shuttle approach, but this was the first time I'd seen it up close. It looked close enough to touch. I could see little scratches and blemishes on the surface finish. I tracked slowly around, realizing that there were ports facing aft as well, and there, stretching out into the star-spackled deep dark, was the rest of the Lois McKendrick. It was not merely huge. Leviathan never seemed so appropriate a term. Gantry lights extended down the spine of the ship, illuminating the container tugs that were moving the big triangular cargo boxes ever so gently into place and locking them down. There were 12 sections of containers reaching out into the dark. Way out at the end of the main spine, a small white light, 200 meters out, marked the sternpost. In one instant I went from feeling like I was crammed in a shoebox to something akin to a flea on a pachyderm. I was still chuckling as I got to the berthing area and started changing into civvies. They were getting kind of not worn exactly, tired maybe. My good boots weren't all that good compared to some of the footwear I'd seen in the last 5 months. My jacket was a little more than an outdated windbreaker. My pants were what my mother called good solid trousers. Bleh. I put them on because that's all I had. I had a sudden insight into why people dressed up when they changed into civvies. After months of ship suits, as nice and practical as they were for what we did on a daily basis, putting on civvies ought to be something special. If I got new clothes, I'd have to get rid of these or take the hit on my mass allotment, but I understood why so many people did exactly that. I saw the boy toy belt hanging in the back of the locker then, and with a sudden burst of daring, I stripped out my old perfectly adequate belt and buckled on the supple leather with its gold metal and black dragon. I looked at myself in the mirror, and if I were perfectly honest, it looked a tad out of place. It didn't go with the rest of the outfit at all. It did, however, go with me. So I kept it on, scooped up the cargo duffel that Pip and I had packed the night before, slammed my locker, and headed for the cargo lock. I got there just after 0700. There was a crowd gathered already. I walked up to see what they were looking at and burst out laughing. When we first got the grav pallet for Mr. Cotton, I could see why it had been slated for salvage. It was pretty torn up. It would only lift about half its rated capacity. For our purposes, that was fine, since its rated capacity was in kilotons. We only needed to carry a few dozen kilos and style points. The pallet was now painted a matte black, and the top, where it had been heavily scarred by dropped loads and untold cargo calamities, was now covered with a uniform layer of pristine gray skid grid, the same nubbly rubbery matting that they laid down on cargo entries and engineering spaces where good footing was important. Along the skirting on all four sides, someone had stenciled McKendrick Mercantile Cooperative in a gray paint that matched the skid grid. Judging from the gray smudges on Biddy Murphy's cheek, I knew who'd done that. The black told me where Pip had found wet paint the day before. There was already a stack of gear on the pallet, including a basket with the banner and table coverings. I added my duffel to the pile, and we all stood there looking at it for a moment before Roan, the morning booth manager, took the tow handle and slid the pallet out of the lock. I stood there watching them go for a moment. I didn't really know what I felt. This crazy group of people going off on a great adventure that was no more exotic than a yard sale. The gray hairs were having as much fun as the kids. It was made all the more surreal when I thought that what they do in real life, when they're not selling trinkets at flea markets, is sailing a deep space leviathan between the stars. That wasn't exciting because that was just their job. You better hurry, Ishmael. They'll leave you behind. I turned to see the captain standing there beside me, looking at the parade streaming out of her ship and across the orbital's dock. "Aye, sir, by your leave," I said, saluting for what might have been the first time since signing the articles. The captain smiled at me, returned the salute, and said, "Carry on, Mr. Wang, carry on." As I stepped out through the lock, I swear I heard Lois laughing. Thanks for listening to Episode 17 of Quarter Share, a trader's tale from the golden age of the solar eclipse.